an Elizabethan church warden writes in the books, it should be a cause of shame to us that 20 years ago in the time of popery, they were so zealous in raising funds. But I'm wondering if there's a picture emerging here of a more general culture of people in those offices looking back through what they're...
It does make you wonder, doesn't it? Because why was Tricky worried about crossing it out? Because who is he actually accountable apart from Parrish? In his instance, he did it more or less straight away.
Yeah.
That was someone coming to look
from outside.
Part of
version of that story is that Tricky is extraordinarily sensitive to outside authority and that Morbark's a very well-governed place.
But yes, the thing with Eton, that's it. Why did they do that? And sometimes you get the fingers pointing at particular entries, don't you? As if drawing to attention. But it's hardly going to be drawing attention to the person who's just written it.
Mm-hmm.
It's again, maybe they're expecting people to look at them. But they're not really scrutinised necessarily by outside authorities. It's only the parish looking back.
So a form of chronicle.
It could have been the archdeacon, I suppose, coming to check up, because there was a sort of legal requirement that church wardens render accounts. But I had a query in the extraordinary image, which I must say I haven't seen before, of the brass showing the preaching. Do you think that the people who were not clearly shown in tall pews were standing? Were more than half the congregation standing?
It's actually quite difficult because the church itself is very small and there are no pews there anymore. The inside has been changed, so it's quite difficult to tell. Because that gives the impression of a very large number of people. The building is a bit bigger than this room, but not appreciably from that point of view. So it does look a bit like they're standing. But it's an image that was made for the church, but whether it's an image of the church is, we don't know.
Mm.
We just don't know.
Time for one more question. Any others? Right, great. Well, Jonathan, go on.
This is a sort of random thought, really, but North Elmham, isn't there a site of Anglo-Saxon cathedral near?
Yeah.
I don't think there's much sort of evidence of their consciousness of any significance about it in the parish.
I have to admit, I only know about that entry in the accounts, but it did occur to me that there was that Anglo-Saxon place up there. So whether they had some sort of tradition of their importance or whatever. But the point about that particular entry, trick is you could see it was about six lines. This one in North Elmham goes on for about three pages, listing individual entries of particular payments. Payments to the wives left behind, interspersed with the purchase of a new psalter book, the taking down of the altars, and this kind of thing. So it's just what was coming into his head. He was just recording all the things that were happening at the time, which is the other interesting thing. He's not separating it out. It's just within the annual accounts. This is what we did this year, and he listed them. And there must be more. I'm sure there are more, because these are three random examples.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know of accounts from 1529, 1550, have a look and see what they're doing. I'm sure there's more of this going on.
Heather, thank you. Thank you very much. So just thank Heather again. Move on to a joint paper. So
yes.
Two speakers. So we have Valerie and Andrew, both from Kent, University of Kent. Speaking to us about the church wardens' accounts. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Heather straight away for illustrating, obviously, the range that you have in a church warden's account, immediately illustrating that they're not just church warden's accounts and some of our problems and what we're dealing with, illustrating also the raiding tendencies that we all have. We've all got our favourite church warden's accounts and we've all gone to them. And also, of course, explaining why Valerie and I are completely mad, because we've been involved in a project to get to the bottom of the full extent and nature of church warden's accounts over a long period. And it is now extended, I should say, following a conference at Kent in 2010, where we were encouraged by people in the room to go from about 1300 to about 1835. So you see how madness kind of takes off. But in my case, we've got three things we want to do. Tell you about where the project's come from. Then, in a sense, I'll hand over very much to Valerie, because she's the one who's really done all the hard work. And then we'll also a big appeal for help at the end. So that's the three things, really. But where we've come from, as I say, is both of us come from an early modern background, and we've got the great Cox, of course, in 1913, attempting to establish lists of church wardens' accounts, But we're very familiar with lots of different people who've raided church wardens' accounts, usually in samples of about 100, 200, for particular reasons. And in our period, David Cressy comes to mind with his great work on bell ringing, Ronald Hutton and the ritual year, on which I did a lot of work after, in terms of the 662 church wardens' accounts that he identified for the period up to 1660. Ken Fincham and Nicholas Tyack have recently used church wardens' accounts extensively in their book on the altars. John Morrill used it a lot in terms of communion wine. So people have used it for particular reasons. We ought to add to the raiders, of course, Jonathan Willis, who's now raiding church wardens' accounts for examples of music, and perfectly justifiably so, and well done in that way. But what we're trying to do is to give everybody some sense of, well, how reliable are these? How, you know, are there problems with these church wardens' accounts? How do they represent all groups of parishes? And so it's a good example, I suppose, of research, because an idiot like me comes along and raises a series of idiot questions. This was in the article in Biatt's book alongside Catherine French and Gary Gibbs. And I raised questions about, well, how many have we got? What percentage? It's about 8% maybe. Is that sort of skewed in any way? I mean, are there more wealthy parishes represented there, more urban or less urban? What about the patronage do we find? What about peculiar jurisdictions? How do they cut across? Are the records that we're dealing with skewed? And they are, of course, skewed geographically. The bulk come from the southern province. We have very few for the north. I think we only have about 6 for all of Wales. So all of us as local historians can need to know, well, what is it you're doing? You know, Clive Burgess, we teased him afterwards when he's working all that stuff on Bristol. He has the best records in the whole country for that period. Yeah, it's amazing, really. So I wrote that kind of thing. And, of course, everybody then as a research supervisor needs a Valerie, because Valerie came along to prove me wrong on all of these things. And first of all, took up a thesis on London and its environs, and sort of started to test some of the things I was looking at. One thing she did very valuably in that thesis, which has since turned into a book, was to do a price index. Because one of the things I was looking at was, have we got a price index for the kinds of things that are going on in church wardens' accounts that would give us some idea of inflation? We've got the Phelps, Brown, Hopkins for sort of consumables and things, but what about bricks and mortar and wood and other things like that? Is there some factor we ought to build in when we gaily say 3 times more was spent in the 1640s as in some earlier period? Back in 2010, we had a big conference at Kent where we floated the idea of trying to do a big project. And as I say, at that conference, 2 things happened. One, people encouraged us to extend the period of cover, which we have done. And secondly, they encouraged us to take a very broad view of what is a church warden's account, bearing in mind what Heather's just been showing about the seepage of material that you might say is in overseers 1 minute or going into another, or extra material coming in. Things that are labelled church warden's accounts in archives frequently are not, and things that are labelled overseers frequently are other things. So there's a kind of problem, an archival problem, behind the scenes. So these were the issues, yes. So church wardens or overseers, sorry.
It's all right. Don't worry about it. That's
13th okay. century to 1835.
This is an example of the problems you hit. This is half the entry from a catalogue, which looks great. You think, oh, good. Until you get there and find that's all that actually survives. We've all been there, I'm sure. And then there's the location of the documents. That's as many as I've found so far of places where they're hidden away. The number in London has changed slightly because Guildhall's now closed for this, and they've all gone up to LMA. And a couple in Kent are being combined, so this is slightly out of date, but until they reopen, I'm not changing it.
The USA is the one that I found in California in the Huntington Library. You should say church warden's accounts should not have left this country. But of course, if they went in the 1920s and 30s. But it is a warning to us all that there are strange records in certain places like the Huntington and like the Folger and Chicago. So, what the database will contain.
Hopefully, and that is very hopeful. We will show each year that the counts survive and whether they're full or summary accounts. And the expenditures calculated by the church wardens. If anyone's ever added up a church warden's accounts, they'll know that they're as good at maths as I am. Dreadful. And we will, where we can, you know, if a document is at risk, at least give a warning to that so that people don't go trotting along only to find that it has been removed from circulation. And printed sources, which are just about driving me round the twist at the moment, I've been looking at every reference to churchwardens' accounts that I've found in printed sources, and we're going to list these along with the year of the extract, or if it's a transcription. That will keep us out of mischief for a little bit longer. And for all parishes, we'll show the county and whether it's changed. Probably the dedication, just because that interests me, I have to be honest. And we'll show the where the parishes are on a map, so that if you want to do a comparative study of an area that crosses borders, you will see where they are. The map will look something like that. This is, I'm afraid, a recycled map. And then if, ideally, if you hover over a parish, something like that will come up, giving you the information you require. And possibly even the where the documents are, because that, you know, that little box can be all sorts of things. Added to the website. Can I carry on, Andrew?
No,
please.
No.
We're going to write, hopefully he's going to write, an outline of what the accounts are. This is for people who haven't used them before, what they're likely to find in them, and what surprises they might get as well, I suppose. Articles, we would be looking for people to supply us with articles about their experiences and the work they've done with the accounts. That again is relying on you out there to tell us what's going on. Also, details of research, theses that are sort of nobody will be able to find unless they're told, because so many theses are not published and get hidden away at the British Library with no hint of what's going on in them. A bibliography of all the printed sources and anything else we can find, and links to related sites.
On that, for instance, the links to related sites, obviously we're talking with Beat about putting this on the parish network, but equally there'd be sites like the Clergy of the Church of England database and other things which we'd want to refer people to on that particular one.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the printed sources, I've been checking them for ever since the conference, actually. I'd like to say it's the result why I've gone almost white, but I can't. That's how many sources I've found to date. And that's how many I've checked, so we're nearly there. It looks great. The interesting bit is the 745 parishes where there are no surviving originals, as far as we can tell, but things crawl out of the woodwork. There is some good news, but the bad news, most of the extracts are brief and topic specific. Antiquarians who got a fancy for, you know, sort of certain things like how many books of common prayer were bought, or, you know, anything that interested them as opposed to being of sort of wider interest. The good news, there are 140 sources there. So, sorry, I've got that wrong. There's 745 accounts I've found so far. It's 140 accounts where the originals do not appear to survive. But that is using mainly online catalogues. It's a case of getting to the record offices and actually digging to find the sources. 25% have surviving accounts. That's over the whole period. That's specific. That amounts to that many parishes, which is quite a lot. I think it's more than I expected. But they all need checking. I blame this gentleman for this. Andrew's always interested in the percentages or how many. So I did this. This is how, if you divide the number of surviving accounts by the number of parishes there are, that's how it breaks down for the periods. So it's very small pre-Reformation. It's not exactly large anywhere, but it's, you know, acceptable. If I divide the surviving records, that's how it comes up.
But what's interesting, I don't know whether people in the room who've got 18th century expertise or 19th century, is notice that there could be bunching. The 1600 to 1750 is, go back if you would, Valerie, one. You know, you've there got, you know, up to 15 and 21%, but then dropping back down. So you would expect records in a sense, unless, of course, something is happening with the church warden system and maybe they're not being valued as much as the type of accounts. But I leave that as a question for 18th and 19th century historians to tell us the answer to. Certainly what it confirms for the earlier period is that figure of about 8% suggests that my original guess estimates were roughly in the right kind of zone. What was interesting, we learned at Kent, is the very good survival from London, in terms of Vanessa Harding telling us about, you know, extremely good survival. When you think of the fire of London soon after and so on, but then, and then the Blitz, you'd expect a lot to have gone. In fact, we do have very good records for London. And we do have a skewed distribution. Urban records are very well represented for this country. So again, that might tie in, though, in some cases with wealth. Not all, because urban livings, of course, are often very poor.
Back to that one. The changes are obviously greater, but in the same key, it drops after 1750, it starts to drop again. I don't know why, but there we are. And now the important bit, what we want from you, we need people to help collect data. We need, ideally, somebody who will... Regional coordinator isn't really the right word, but somebody who's, you know, sort of, ideally we'd like somebody up in Yorkshire and somebody in Lancashire and, you know, that sort of thing, who would just sort of keep an eye on our volunteer collectors. As I said before, provide articles, details of research. We need, obviously, help with the management team and the editorial teams. So... that's it. And just in case you're in doubt, the database will enable document location, make it much easier. Make it easier to find what you're looking for so you know whether you're going to actually achieve anything by a long distance journey across the country. The maps, I hope, will help with that, the making comparative studies. It will also make it easier if you want to, as I say, you know, sort of cover several counties or even, you know, one up there and one down here. You could do a lot of the preliminary work before you leave home. That goes without saying, and that one, I hope.
Well, you didn't have the map. You only showed me the map.
I only showed you the map.
Oh, right.
I do have a map showing the percentages of survival for each county of England and Wales. If people would like, it can be passed around, but there is only one copy of each.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
So, as you said this at the beginning, can I just ask about the timescales for this? When can we expect this lovely new resource to be available to us?
Well, I will pass that over. But we did try for some funding, from the Pilgrim Trust, and we wrote out the usual things, and we didn't get very far. We were struck by the $400,000 for John's project, and we were sort of thinking, well, we only need a bit. A few thousand would do us for this.
Okay.
But we're heartened by the fact that the Clergy of the Church of England database operated off about, what was it, about 100 or so volunteers around the country who were feeding information in. And if we can set up a website relatively soon, possibly hosted by the University of Kent, but maybe also we'll talk with Beat here, and then that will give people something to shoot at. And so the good news will be that somebody out in Cumbria, alas, from our point of view, there probably are only five or six accounts up there, and same with Durham and Northumberland. But in other areas, you know, there are going to be a goodly number to be checked and sorted through. And as I, and unfortunately, with the archive world at the moment facing such cuts, I say this wearing a different hat as chairman of the HA Public History Committee, we're very concerned about the number of archivists around the country losing their jobs and the positions. And therefore, I think a lot more projects like this will end up on our door as volunteers. The historians themselves will be carrying out many of these projects, which in the past might have been seen as archival work, but which we now need to do. And that's good for us as well, because we get a better understanding of the sources if we do that.
So it will build over time?
It will build over time. But we'll put the website up first, because a lot of the material Valerie has already done, and the website itself, I think, will be extremely helpful to people in its own right.
Great. Well, questions, Peter?
Can I ask about, I know this is big enough, mad enough already, but
he's going to if you're going to,
you want to add something.
I mean, my mind is sort of salivating while I listen to it. But I'm wondering about digitalisation. Now, obviously, you know, the two of you, or even team researchers, go around digitalising everything would be lifetime's work. But I mean, one of the things that's clearly happening is that whole squads of research students are going around the country with their cameras.
Yeah.
They're taking photographs of huge amounts of stuff. So there are digitalised versions of important archival material all over the place, but none of that ever gets shared.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there are big sort of copywriting problems here, but whether there might be, you know, some potential for people actually contributing.
I actually asked an archive office if I could actually use a slide that I'd taken on this, just for this, because I didn't know whether I was violating copyright. And she said, did we give you permission to take the photograph? And I said, yes. Did you pay? And I said, yes. She said, in that case, you can use it, but you can't publish it. If I want to publish, and I think if you put it on the web, they would call that publishing, you need a whole set of new sort of permissions, which no doubt will cost money. I don't know.
I think we're also going to find that the archive world is looking, reviewing the charges at the very moment. They certainly are down in Chichester, that as the cuts continue to bite, looking at this is one of them. I mean, the worst place I've been to is the Bedfordshire Record Office, lovely record office. They charge £1 a photograph. Other places are charging, what, £5 a day, £10 a day, £15 a day, or whatever. All of those charges are likely to be reviewed. They're all likely then to have all the kind of problems that we're talking about. I take your point entirely that ideally there's a kind of critical moment, isn't it? The digital revolution should pay dividends. Yeah. But
the trouble is they'd end up suing the University of Kent to actually have enough money to pay.
All right, I'm not sure they do.
Because my local archive, Cheshire, and they're currently, I think, fundraising by doing this because they've digitised all the wills and they're on Find My Past. So obviously, you've got to pay and the government's got a cut of it, presumably.
Yeah, we're very concerned, of course, about the number of records that are being commercialised, and the problem then of how many of our records we're suddenly going to have to pay for through other kind of means. As we go around the country, you find different practices. I have talked with Oliver Morley at the TNA because they have taken over the role that the Museums, Libraries and Archives Quango had, and technically have a role in looking at how the county archivists are doing and come some kind of policy. And I've urged him to think about what is the impact of the digital revolution. If you want to hear that interview, it's a podcast on the TNA website with me interviewing Oliver Morley on that kind of issue. But there are a number of threats. I mean, the other one for historians of our period is the whole Cengage calendar kind of state papers domestic, and how many universities can afford those. And I've been talking with a number of people here today who've suddenly said they can no longer get the early English books online because their university has stopped paying, and therefore they've suddenly been cut off. So there are interesting issues around, aren't there, for all of us doing research on this.
There's a question here.
You had an end date of 1835. How much longer did churchwardens' accounts continue for?
Well, they still go on today. Is how long they stayed interesting, should we say. I don't mean that unkindly. Some people actually find accounts interesting. But at some point towards the end of the 18th century, they started to bring in printed accounts where their actual accounts were submitted and printed, and the printed copy is what the parishioners saw. So a lot of the finer detail that you get in the older churchwardens' accounts, my favourite example is somebody who paid for 1,971 nails, you know. It's that sort of thing that sort of, it just makes them human. When you just see, you know, work done on the tower, you know, floor being polished, you know, it doesn't have that sort of local impact. And I mean, 1835 is almost too late, because so many of the churches have gone over to printed accounts by then. At the actual conference, I think somebody suggested we went up to 1850. I've pulled that back just slightly because of this. Basically, it's going to, I think, be flexible to the extent that as long as the accounts remain handwritten,
it's the identifying.
Yes, I think as long as they remain handwritten, although there are some accounts in Chichester, which I virtually slashed my wrist. They're beautifully handwritten in enormous volume, you know, that opens like this, and it's got the income and the expenditure pages, except they don't use them like that. And on the pages, they've got separate accounts for the pew account, the communion bread account, the something else account, the something else. And there's all these accounts. Nowhere do they collate it so that you get a grand total. So you can't easily say, well, in this particular year they spent £104.19, which is ideally what I want to do on the database. Test my maths, I can tell you. But perhaps I can be as inaccurate as the church wardens were. Mind you, if you're adding up in a combination of Roman numeral and whatever we use now, is it Arabic? It's not surprising they made mistakes, is it? You know, one time they'll say 12 pennies and another time they'll say 1 shilling. You know, that's why they made mistakes.
Time for one last question. Yes, please.
You mentioned the overlap with overseers' accounts, you know, very often church wardens' accounts that contain them and vice versa. How are you dealing with that? Are you kind of including the overseers' accounts if they're like in the same book?
Yes, if they're in the same. The original documents I've done, which is about 300 or 400 only, if when I scan down the page, I see, you know, they've paid to the poor, or they've paid a pension, or they've bought stockings for somebody, then I've put a note including overseers, but it may not be the total overseers, so there's going to be a big caveat on that.
But if there's a book, say, that's got the church wards at one site, then you reverse the book.
That's fine.
Charity accounts or church
that's fine. It's when they're included. And the other time is you find that sometimes it says overseers accounts, and then when you actually look at the overseers accounts, you find that they've paid for the pews to be repaired or something else, or the glass. So you've got this combination. I sometimes wonder if in the smaller parishes the church warden and the overseer are one and the same person.
Yeah.
And he just writes it in the wrong book. And, you know, it's... I don't know, but you know, if I see that, I'm making a note about
that's
it.
That's going to be clear on the
page. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And there will be an enormous health warning on the website as well, because they don't always give you accurate dates, you know, for the year of. You know, does that mean from, you know, Easter or Lady Day to Lady Day? Does it mean the annual year? Does it mean the regnal year? So, you know, all that is going to be given in the health warning.
And the word vestry accounts or vestry minutes.
Yeah, where they're included, where the vestry minutes include a summary of the church warden's accounts. Yeah. Sometimes they include the whole thing, of course, but mostly it's only a summary of like income expenditure. I'm making a note of it, but putting it down as a vestry summary.
Great. Well, thank you very much again. Thank you. I look forward to that very much.
Great. So, can we get
Sarah
back?
So Peter's now going to talk to us. Reverend Peter Kettle is going to talk to us about a discovery of objects as well as records, which sounds fascinating. So, Peter, when you're ready.
Well, I fear that this presentation is rather outside the declared time span of this conference. It concerns parish records from the 1850s onwards and will even mention the 20th century. However, it does follow on in one respect from the presentation we've just had, in that they are very human records. But I shall also want to suggest that the discovery of these records, and again following on from what you've just said, has implications in terms of the broader span of history, because we've talked about moving from handwritten records to printed records. We are now in a digital age, and I just wonder what the future is for the continuing maintenance of records of any form in this digital age. The dual dedication of the parish in which I'm honorary curate indicates the scope of this presentation. Although a third church, Holy Trinity Knightsbridge, predates both. That church was rebuilt several times, the last of which in 1861 looks from extant photographs spectacularly ugly. A new incumbent in 1895 had a vision of closing this church and building a new one further away on land south of the Royal Albert Hall, owned by the 1851 commissioners. They had started to lease land for mansion blocks, only some of which were ever built, the victim of a property crash. And thus the resulting new parish church, with the same dedication and usually known as Holy Trinity Prince Consort Road, consecrated in 1903, that church, my church, has never served more than a small resident population. Its architect was G.F. Bodley and is considered by some to be his last great masterpiece. Back in the 1840s, another local clergyman, William Harness, a childhood friend of Byron, was planning to build a new church amongst the contemporary speculative developments between Knightsbridge and the Brompton Road opposite Harrods. All Saints Ennismore Gardens, designed by Vulliamy, has been the Russian Orthodox Cathedral since the 1950s and was well known during the second half of the 20th century for its Christmas and Easter broadcasts on the BBC World Service, led by Archbishop Anthony Bloom, and providing spiritual succour to the Orthodox community in the USSR. Of All Saints, the Survey of London notes, in these surroundings of residential developments from the 1840s to the 1960s, the Lombardic architecture of All Saints strikes an unexpectedly exotic note. When All Saints was closed for Anglican worship in 1954, its parish was combined with that of Holy Trinity, providing something of a boost to that small resident population. One of the attractions for me of Holy Trinity is that it has not, to put it mildly, been over-disturbed by a need to modernise or improve its late Victorian furnishings and contents. The disappearance of its original sanitary ware a few years ago in the interests of health and safety was a sad moment. But about 5 years ago, I simply asked the question, what's in that top cupboard in the choir vestry? Oh, just some old papers. And there, in a couple of tin boxes, battered attaché cases and pink-ribboned bundles, was an undisturbed treasure of original documents. Design and building records of Bodley and Vulliamy, correspondence concerning the new parish and fundraising material, parish newsletters and magazines, very much latter-day churchwardens' accounts, printed ones, and much apparently mundane material pertaining to the life of the parishes down the decades. The same was discovered for All Saints, with the significant addition of a parish chronicle for 1917 to 1925, kept by the then vicar, a sort of blog of its time, I suppose. My first attempt at making use of this material concerned the building of the new church, and I shall show display three papers. I do have a few copies if anyone is interested in them. Most towns and cities contain unfinished churches, the results of enthusiasm over sound financial sense, and many of them present ugly, truncated, temporary walls where the money ran out. Although Holy Trinity was eventually completed, the process was not easy. Funding was partly from the sale of the site of the old Holy Trinity, and the business plan, as we would describe it these days, was shaky from the start. The church commissioners and their secretary, Sir Alfred Porter, were careful about releasing money. Only 2 months after the foundation stone was laid, he wrote, "In future, some portion of the expenditure certified must be provided from other income." And on another occasion, you requested a further 1,000, but 4,500 of the original 8,000 has already gone, and only £500 has been paid for from other sources. The vicar became very anguished, facing bankruptcy. In a letter to Lord Ashcombe, a local resident, former church commissioner, and somewhat reluctant supporter of the new church, he wrote, "Your offer to guarantee £3,000 if five others will join you is kind, but unfortunately it does not help me. When you were kind enough to make the same offer some time ago, I tried my hardest to get the other five, but did not succeed in getting one. I have no reason whatever to hope for success now. I must see Sir Alfred Porter tomorrow and let him know the awful predicament I'm in. I fear he will have nothing to suggest. The building operations, of course, must stop, but I fear that unless the ecclesiastical commissioners will pay the amount already due to the builders, I am ruined. One is wise after the event, but I never for a moment expected when I embarked upon the scheme that it would be so miserably supported. Nor, I am sure, did your lordship." There is a large collection of responses to what I think was a rather poorly organised appeal, not all of which were forthcoming with positive responses. "Pray forgive my not having answered your letter of 23rd of November sooner. I regret this all the more as I do not find myself able to help in the matter of the new church in Prince Consort Road. I should like to add that I have hitherto considered myself lucky in not being near a church with bells, and I dread the prospect of having some in the immediate vicinity." This, of course, is a debate that goes on, but I wonder whether Anna Goodenough was the earliest recorded sufferer of such malaise. Another letter. "I write to say that I'm a Roman Catholic and consequently am not interested in the new church, having my own to attend. signature most likely to be that of Lord Alfred Douglas. Amongst correspondence with the architect, one letter confirms the findings of Michael Hall, author of the forthcoming biography on Bodley, that he was frequently bothered by offers of inappropriate furnishings for the churches. As a rule, I do not quite like old things placed in a new church. It gives a sort of museum-like look. The old font, on offer, the old font would look better in an old church. I hope the lady will not mind me saying this regarding her kind offer. What one wants is unity of effect, so that I should prefer to design a new font. I know we all want to get for the church what we can, and it seems ungracious to decline a gift, which is no doubt of much value. And after dealing with other matters, he adds, P.S. I'm sorry, but I fear I cannot like the idea of an old font in a new church. The first vicar died after a ministry at his new church of 30 years, upon which a churchwarden wrote a beautifully composed letter to the bishop, worrying about his inexperience in dealing with an interregnum. The bishop's short reply included the statement, "No doubt you have a curate." Indeed, there was one, but a dispute over payment for Christmas services left the churchwarden once again writing an elegant, if pained, letter expressing deep sadness at the tangle he had got into. My second paper gives an overview of the 10 incumbents of All Saints Ennismore Gardens. Three of them engaging extrovert figures, two of them quite mad, and two of them probably clinically depressed at the time. One of them being Ralph Inge, later to achieve fame as Dean of St Paul's. But for the purpose of this presentation, I want to highlight a very small bundle of three letters in the archives, two of which are thank you letters from the two depressed clergymen. One of them is frank. No one can be more conscious than I am of my failure to grapple with many of the problems of a London parish. Inge's letter at first appears disingenuous. I'm very grateful for this token of friendliness and goodwill, and shall also always value it as a memorial of the three happiest years of my life so far. He does at least put on record, "I feel on my side that I have learnt a great deal from my ministry in a London parish, which I hope may be of assistance to me." But having recently looked at Inge's letters held in Magdalen College, Cambridge, the truth about his short time as Vicar of All Saints appears more complex, and I hope to do further work on this short period of his life. But the third letter in this bundle is extraordinary. The last fairly disastrous Vicar of All Saints, Frederick Henry Amphlett Micklewright, was, in rough chronological order, an Anglican curate, Unitarian minister, Anglican clergyman again, lawyer, author of the longest PhD thesis ever submitted to London University, militant secularist, and finally a Roman Catholic subscribing to the Latin Mass Society. A note on the rear cover of a memoir of him states, "He succeeded in perplexing as many people as he inspired." But the letter in our archives reads, "Dear Vicar, I hope all is well with you and your family, and that your future will be happy. I do thank you and Mrs. Micklewright very much for the many happy Sunday evenings at your home. Enjoyed being with you all thoroughly, and I'm sure others must have felt the same. It was so nice of you to have had us. When living alone, we do appreciate being with a family in a homely way such as yours." My third paper so far is really just a transcript with notes of the aforementioned Chronicle of All Saints. What I wish to highlight today is the fact that it covers the period of the establishment of parochial church councils. Together with ruridecanal conferences, these were, as far as I'm aware, the first real opportunity for a range of lay people to be officially involved in church life at a local level, apart from being church warden. I do not know the extent to which church wardens until recent times were women, but the recording of elections in the Chronicle shows a significant number of women being elected to both. At this time, of course, in national politics, the Qualification of Women Act 1918 had given limited votes to women, but it was not until 1928 that women were granted the right to vote on the same terms as men. These elections are perhaps but a footnote in the emergence of women taking their place in society, but interesting nevertheless. And it would again be interesting to know whether that was happening in other parishes of perhaps different social composition. Well, after hardly bearing to let all this stuff go, I finally managed to deposit all this in the City of Westminster archives last autumn, and am now turning to material from the 1950s onwards. At first, I thought this later material might be of less interest, and indeed, it's not as sexy as the earlier material. It covers, after all, my own lifetime, which I know well about, don't I? Mm-hmm. But we have a complete set of parish magazines since 1954, and a good quantity of other, perhaps more ephemeral, material. And in the magazines, I come across Anxieties of the Times, a recommendation for a good painter and decorator known to a member of the congregation, who nevertheless comes with the apparently necessary note that he is West Indian. And vicar's letters from the 1960s, worrying endlessly about the permissive society. Remember that. There is no local history society in Knightsbridge or South Kensington. So there is, as far as I'm aware, little local consciousness of the implications of destroying family or business archives, which could contribute so much to what is rapidly becoming a lost world. The old aristocracy and middle classes who lived in the single dwellings of the stuccoed terraces have, of course, long since gone, and for the last 60 years been replaced by a much more transient population of flat dwellers who are, I suppose, even less likely to leave us valuable material. That transition is particularly well, if rather bitterly, documented in the vicar's letters in All Saints Parish magazine in the 1940s. And earlier, in the All Saints Chronicle, Canon Dean bemoaned the fact that Sunday congregations plummeted, especially at Christmas, Easter and Whitsun, by what, in more recent fictionalised form, Lady Grantham in Downton Abbey has famously questioned as, "What is a weekend?" And of course we might note that both of those clergy's anxieties would have been compounded by the fact that if there wasn't a congregation around at Easter, he wasn't going to get the offering. Only recently I contacted a local ward councillor with the same unusual surname as one on the war memorial at All Saints, just in case there was a connection, only to discover that it was her grandfather and that she possessed a remarkable manuscript memoir of her grandmother, who widowed in the Great War with a young child and another on the way after only a short married life, then had to find her way in the world. Her achievement could have been a further resource for Virginia Nicholson's book Singled Out, How 2 Million Women Survived Without Men After the First World War, in which she often uses unpublished memoirs and diaries of some of these women. I recognise that much of this is social rather than ecclesiastical history. But the raison d'etre of Anglican parish churches is, of course, umbilically bound with the localities they serve. And as I think these archives illustrate, can provide some valuable, if at times seemingly mundane, local history material. And apart from some building records, very little of this constitutes official parish records as defined by the Church of England. Of course, as we all know, when clearing out the homes of deceased relatives, it feels impossible to keep every scrap of paper, let alone objects of historical interest, if not value. But I also wonder whether, in this new digital age, when paradoxically it's easy to save documents and communications on the computer, whether even significant archival material, let alone the more ephemeral nature material of some of the things mentioned today, whether that is in fact being kept as we have in older paper form. Thank you.
Thank you. Great, open up to questions. Can I start off? I have a question about the original archivist. Any idea about the identity of who?
Absolutely no idea.
It's been carefully packaged.
Some of them have been carefully packaged, especially the All Saints records.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's especially fortunate that they survived, because the condition of All Saints when it closed, I think due to the last vicar, was particularly appalling. Right. So we were very lucky.
So you don't know at what point these things were cut? Very carefully stowed away and preserved.
Certainly the earlier ones, there are, for example, little bundles of receipts of payment to the pew opener at All Saints in the 1850s and 60s.
Like so that. The tins don't give you any clue as to date
anymore? No.
Any other questions? Oh, two over here, so start. Thank you.
I just wondered, how long was the longest thesis ever
submitted? Memory serves me correct. Does 100,000 words sound a lot?
No.
I've got it somewhere. but it was. New rules were introduced after that.
Yes.
Just the record that began in 1917, the blonde black one, was that? Does it say that it was prompted by a wish to record the reaction of people to the war?
No. No, it was obviously started mid-war.
Yeah.
There's no clue as to why he started it then. He started it because he'd just become vicar of the parish.
Right. And he hadn't done the same at the previous parish,
had he? Not that I know of, but I've not. He came from Worcestershire, and I'm afraid I've not got up to Worcestershire.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking that I have come across some people in different parts of the country did, as the war got going, feel that they ought to make a record. They sensed that it was going to go on for a while yet, and that what was happening was unprecedented, and indeed that there was always the real danger of bombs being dropped and so on. So people were stimulated into responses.
No, I would say that there are passing references to the war, but it was the church and parish life that was his concern.
Presumably there's no record of this part of London becoming cosmopolitan, because people coming in have been drawn into central London and wouldn't have gone to the Church of England.
In the 1840s, I think they would, in that kind of area. Turn of the century, and I think the evidence of the appeal responses is that there was a very considerable Roman Catholic and nonconformist residency in the area. Yes.
Thank you. You go first.
Sorry. Can I just ask,
how were the records received when you finally got around to depositing them in the City of Westminster? Well, I think we're linking into the sort of like the previous presentation.
Mm.
Once you've given them, with all the cuts in the archives and whatever, was there a sort of sense that you might have actually lost access in some way to them?
Mm. Well, I had a moment of panic before that happened, because in an early discussion with the staff there, one of them said, of course, we don't want... We don't want the receipts for every match every box of matches that was bought. And I thought, that's unfortunate. However, I simply deposited everything that I'd got. At the moment, they simply appear on the website listing as archival material with beginning and end dates.
They've not been catalogued.
I did try to order them and enclosed a list of a kind of index in case nothing got done. I suspect nothing has, but at least they're there.
Would you be able to get them back if you changed your mind or if access became very restricted? I think this is going to become quite an issue. Yeah.
As far as I know, as far as I'm aware, they're on loan. Can anyone help me on that?
Yes, they're on loan. They remain to the church.
The
quite right, there's a major worry there. Mm-hmm. The Historic Association is looking into that as well, in terms of talking about archivists, because many archivists are now complaining that they had, once upon a time, purpose-built buildings. Chichester's a case in point. And it's now had to give up space for coroners and registrars. So it was one of the first purpose-built record offices back 10, 20 years ago. It doesn't exist as a purpose-built one anymore. And there are also heavy restrictions coming in as to what records they will take in.
Right.
And they are putting more ring fences around what they see as their statutory obligation, according to the 1958 Act, that they will take.
I may have got in just in time.
They're also talking about sampling.
Yes.
Which... sent shudders down my
spine. But we had, for ecclesiastical historians, an issue, because a large number of archivists are senior archivists, are being made redundant or are retiring early and so on. And there are now cases of archives where the archivists themselves would say, I'm sorry, we don't know what this collection is all about and what's in it. And also catalogues go missing. Anything they haven't got on the computer, they claim they don't have.
I think with my material culture hat on, I would want to preserve a sense of the original filing system, you know, how those things have been originally bundled together.
Yes.
So it's, again, a question whether that...
I have done in what I've sent off.
I'm sorry, I do think that most of the archivists do have access to the acknowledge that the documents should be kept as far as possible as they're arrived, you know, if they're in a particular bundle. Because you get these funny bundles where, you know, you can go through them and you get all sorts of things within the bundle because they've maintained it as it was acquired. You know, I think that helps you sort of get the feel of it.
Any last questions? In that case, can we thank Peter again and... invite our final speaker this afternoon to come up. So, Sylvia,
yes, that's it.
Do you want to just see if
just make sure it's all working?
Just to introduce Sylvia from the University of Leicester.
Yes.
And talking to us about Ledbury.
Ledbury, yes.
Thank you.
Because affiliation with the University of Leicester, but also with the Victoria County History Trust in Herefordshire. I'm hoping in this paper to bring together quite a lot of the strands and concerns of this symposium, in that the paper is looking at a particular class of document, Easter books, often bundled up with tithe books, but also looking at how we used the Easter book for Ledbury in a project that involved working between academic historians, local volunteers, local archaeologists, a very interdisciplinary project, and involving, as I say, professional and amateur historians. Local, in fact, many of the people who got involved in the project had never done any history at all, not even family history, but became involved in the project. It was one of the Victoria County History Trust's England's Past for Everyone projects, which ran for 5 years. I was the team leader and worked with other VCH colleagues, timber framed experts, the county archaeologist, and over the 5 year period we had about 50 local people get involved in various ways in transcription projects and oral history and so on and so forth. So this is really focusing on one particular document, but also looking out as into how we linked it with other sources and documents. And a lot of the analysis, initial analysis of this book, was done by my colleague John Chandler, to give everyone their due. And talking of dues, of course, we're all aware of tithes, and we've just had in the last paper mention to the Easter offerings, and it's really the Easter offerings, the small but regular sums that were obliged to be paid by parishioners to the minister, the priest in their parish, which was a major part of the income, particularly in the case of a vicarage where the rectory would take the larger part of the income, and the vicar was very much reliant on the Easter dues, the small sums that came in, the fees for marriages and recording births and burial services and so on, and also the small tithes. The large tithes, the great tithes, went to the rector. This was the 10th part of the increase of corn and hay. The mixed tithes, which was garden produce, animals, pigs, lambs, eggs, all these sorts of things, were to go to the minister. These tithes we often set out in the Glebe Terriers. Glebe Terriers, by the very nature of the name terrier, lists the property that belonged to the rectory, but they often also set out what is the custom of that particular parish in the way of tithe payments. For although tithe in its simplest form is a tenth part of the increase, and is there in biblical injunctions and became formalised in England, certainly in the Saxon period, there is quite a considerable variation from parish to parish in the sort of nitty-gritty, particularly for the small and mixed tithes, of just what was collected and how it was collected, and when it became inconvenient for the vicar to collect eggs from every single parishioner. I mean, how many omelettes can one vicar eat, I asked myself. The Easter dues, the offerings, are the part that I'm really going to concentrate on today. And these were small payments, often in the early modern period, tuppence, sometimes only a penny, ahead of each person over communicable age who had taken communion. So round about the age of 14. Some parishes, the tithe books actually say it's all those over the age of 16. So it's not, again, absolutely rigid and across the board, but round about 14, 16 years old is when you take your first communion, and after that point you have to pay your Easter dues. And obviously it was an important matter to the resident priest, often the vicar, as I say, to record what was owed to him and what he'd actually managed to collect. These Easter books are even less frequent survivals than the church warden's accounts. There hasn't been a major study that I'm aware of. Susan Wright wrote some articles in the 1980s introducing the Easter books as a source, and talks a little bit about some of the ones that she had identified, but I'm not aware that anyone since has done a sort of major database project on these books. They tend to survive from the mid-16th century up to 1835-6, with the commutation of Tithe Act of 1835. That sort of was the end of them. Although I have found a reference to book in Leeds University Library for Bradfield, which covers a period 1502 to 1517, which would be very interesting to have a closer look at some point. Some parishes, you've just got a small glimpse, you know, maybe a year or two. Others, there are really good long runs. Ludlow in Shropshire, for example, has got a run which goes from 1717 up to 1835. And I notice on the Hertfordshire Record Society table downstairs that there's the Amwell Parish Register and Tithing Book and the Datchworth Tithe Account 1711 to 1747. So these sorts of books also get printed sometimes by record societies. Having a quick browse through the Amwell book, which calls itself the Tithing Book, I see there that has exactly what I said about what you find sometimes in terriers, where it sets out the custom of this parish is we will collect these sorts of pieces. Some of the books which survive are called on the book, never mind in the catalogue of the record office, Easter book. Sometimes they're called Paschal rolls or Easter rolls. Sometimes they're called other things entirely. They might be called something else, be part of some other document or book, so that from the catalogues and indexes in the record office you might not realise that you're going to find these. They might be interspersed amongst other things. But I'm now going to turn to Ledbury, just to introduce those of you who have not had the pleasure of coming down to Herefordshire. Ledbury is a small market town in eastern Herefordshire under the lee of the Malvern Hills. It's quite a large parish physically. It's a small market town, but quite a large rural parish around it, running up onto the lower slopes. Have we got one of those pointy things here or not? No. Never mind. Just running up onto the hills, and also coming towards the camera as far as the River Leddon, which is about where those trees are. So it's a mixed parish. In the Middle Ages, the borough was a borough, although it long since gave up sending anyone to Parliament, and there's no borough structure. It was simply run as a parish. It was entirely a manor of the bishops of Hereford, which has helped with the survival of records generally. There's quite a good run of things. The parish was a vicarage. The rectory was divided into two portions. The portionaries were appointed by the bishops, and by the later 16th century, the two portions, known as Upper and Lower Hall, were let to laymen, leased to laymen. I'm going to concentrate on the urban aspect of the parish particularly, and looking at the use that we made of the Easter book in our project to write a history of Ledbury, and by looking at the way we used it, hopefully give you some ideas of the ways in which these sorts of documents can be mined for information, particularly if you can then ally them with other records such as the parish registers and probate documents, and you may even be lucky enough to tie people mentioned in them to particular buildings, which is even more exciting. The Ledbury Easter book, it's quite a large volume, but mutilated. You can see the rather despairing disclaimers written by a later vicar on the front page and on the back page, saying that it was like this when it was handed over to me. It wasn't me that did it. Even in the middle, there's a few pages are missing, and again, there's another of Mr. Walker's little things, the memorandum that the latter part of this book was cut off when I received it from my predecessor's widow, Mrs. Pritchard. Beginning of it, there are just a few pages surviving from 1595. Then pretty good coverage up to 1607, although 1607 doesn't quite get finished. So the last complete year is 1606. The chap who kept it was William Davis alias Weaver. There was a family of Davises alias Weavers in Ledbury at this time, all sort of interrelated, but I haven't quite been able to pin down William Davis, alias Lee Weaver's exact family connections, nor have I been able to trace him through the database of clergy or put him in one of the universities, which is really rather annoying. But he was obviously an educated and very well organised person because of the way that this book is kept, and also the way that the parish registers were kept at this time. He was vicar from 1576 to 1612, and may actually be the clerk who was mentioned in the 1560s. He might have been the sort of curate there before he became vicar. The parish registers instituted during his time following the 1597 Act are beautifully kept. We have the paper and the best parchment copies running through from 1556 into the early 17th century. Excellent coverage there. So good, in fact, that Ledbury was one of the parishes that was used by Ridley and Schofield when they did their database and analysis of population for England. So this is a really marvellous resource. I can't help wondering, though, whether this efficiency and bureaucracy and absolutely getting every tenth leek out of those gardens in the borough wasn't perhaps the background to the falling out that William Davis had with some of his parishioners. We've just got a little bit of some case papers where he was sued for, there was a libel case and all sorts of scurrilous material, but that's another story for another day. I don't go down there. But we're going to concentrate on the Easter book now. The way it's arranged is every year follows the same pattern. It's really legible for a late 16th century book, which is wonderful in itself. Very neatly organised and follow the same pattern year by year, which gives us, over the practically decade of complete returns, a good opportunity to do some analysis. As I say, everyone over communicable age was to pay a small fee. In Ledbury, it was tuppence, and so fourpence for a married couple. It begins, every entry is organised in order of the streets in the town, and you can see by the way the names run on that each year they go round in the same order, down the same streets, visiting the same houses in the same way to collect everything. And then after the borough, the town streets, each of the hamlets or townships of the rural parish are also written out in the same way. Then follow the collection of tithe eggs. For every hen, pullet and duck, etc., 2 eggs apiece. And for every cock, drake and so on, 3 eggs apiece. Though we must remember, of course, that cocks and drakes don't lay eggs, so that seems a little unfair, but there we are. Then there are the duties paid by the parishioners, set out in order of streets. Then come the payments of the small tithes, the calves, kids, pigs, geese, lambs, down to honey, and as I say, every tenth leek out of the gardens. We used the Easter dues, the lists of householders, to do a lot of analysis, which I'll come to in a second. We were able to supplement this by, if you cross-reference to the tithe payments, you start to get a much fuller picture of the individual people's lives and activities, whether they had gardens, whether they had sheep, whether they kept geese, and so on. For some reason or other, he starts each year of the dues with the servants and apprentices, journeymen, maidens and young people dwelling in the high street and so on through the other streets. At least one other parish, I think it's down in Bristol, their book is set out in the same way, so that St Ewan's in Bristol also has the young people listed separately from the householders. He breaks them down, Mr. Davis does, into those who do take wages and pay for the same. The waged people paid their tuppenny due, and they also paid either tuppence or fourpence for their wages. Although, interestingly, in the high street, three of these men were also paying for hands, i.e. that's people who worked for them. So they must have been journeymen who'd got people working for them already. You will notice down the side, I hope, that there are little crosses, straightforward up crosses, and I think that means they paid. Occasionally there's a blank and no sum entered against it, and occasionally there's a black X-type cross, which presumably means definitely he didn't pay. It's not quite clear with the Ledbury ones what was the basis for calculating how much people paid for their wages. It's a standard tuppence or fourpence. It's obviously not a direct tithe on their wage. In some other parishes, for example, it was done at a particular rate. St. Just in Cornwall, their Easter book runs from 1588 to 1596, a similar period, and their servants paid fourpence for every six and eight they earned, but only a penny each for offerings and tuppence for married couples. Then you move on to the householders. Davies only names the head of the household, but obviously if they're paying fourpence, it implies there was a wife in her indoors that was being paid for. So we can actually calculate the complete adult population by adding the tuppences and the fourpences. Some entries are obviously women as head of households. Some of them are going to be widows, they're single people. Sometimes they actually say, and tuppence for her son, and entries of that sort. Occasionally, people are bracketed, as Christopher Morgan and John Barnard, both mercers here in the High Street, are bracketed, paying fourpence and one penny for a garden. So it's obviously they were sharing a house and garden. This payment of a penny for garden was again common over many, many parishes. A lot of parishes also paid a penny for smoke or chimney, but that doesn't seem to have happened in Ledbury. But again, a very standard charge or due was a penny for each milk cow. And again, notice, even in the High Street in Ledbury, five of the householders were paying for cows, paying for milk money. The personal or privy tithes were collected on profits from trades or crafts or on wages, as we've seen, and these were usually collected at the same time as the Easter offerings. Some towns had very, very complicated arrangements of working out how to tithe people's profits. Others, like Coventry and Leicester, went for something that was more like a rating system on the value of the property of the householder. In Coventry, for example, householders paid 12 pence for every 10 shillings worth of rent per year, the value of their property. Also in this book, there are odd references to the sacrament tokens. In larger parishes, of course, it was going to be quite complicated for the minister to be sure that everybody had come and taken communion at Easter and other appointed times. And so there was quite often a way of selling tokens. They'd collect the Easter dues and give the person a token so that they could say that they had paid, and then they would come to communion and hand over their token, which showed that they'd paid their dues, and also the minister could tot up and make sure that he had given communion to the number of people who should have been there. And there's this nice little reference in 1597 that this year the Easter the tokens were stamped with I or JB. Quite why JB or I'm not sure, but anyway. The book also includes references to payments of tithe corn, which was of course due to the rector, but by custom in Ledbury the rectors of Upper and Over Hall and the dependent chapelries in the surrounding area paid a certain proportion to the vicar. But returning to what you can do with the Easter books, you can look at the population, as I say, because we've got this really detailed account of the number of households. And there we have set out the borough on the top lines and then the various divisions of the rural parish. And so in 1597, we can be fairly sure that the adult population was 1,044, 46, if you can count the vicar and his wife, Joan. That compares with probably about 640 in the parish in 1545 from the chantry certificates. This had increased by 1602 to 554 in the town, and by 1607 there were 624 in the town, whereas the rural population had stayed fairly static. The total population had gone up to 1,157, by 1607. So not a huge increase, but still a steady increase. Ledbury was booming in the 1690s. One interesting point to note, I think, is the number of youths, apprentices, journeymen, etc., living in the house in the high street compared to the number of householders. And I think this is because the high street was the commercial centre of the town, and there would have been more servants and apprentices and journeymen, I assume, working with the tradesmen in that area. We can also learn a lot about occupations from the Easter Book. In 1597, of the 158 male householders, there are occupations given for just over 50%, 81 people, and another 11 of the young men. The largest number of artisan retailers in Ledbury were the leather workers, 8 tanners, 12 corvisers, 4 glovers and others, 28 in all in the leather trade, compared with only 6 weavers and 5 clothiers. But the clothiers do seem to have been the wealthiest group of all. In 1606, there are occupations for 97 out of 183 householders, 11 what you might call professional gentry, vicar, schoolmaster, bailiff, parish clerk, surgeon, and the master of the hospital, and 6 farmers. And then there were 12 in the food and drink trades, 12 in construction, 6 smiths, a cutler, a cooper, a fletcher, and a tinker. And the rest were connected with clothing, 15, and fully 24 people in the leather trades. This compares interestingly with Worcester in the 16th century, the work done by Dyer, which shows that 50% of known occupations were to do with the cloth trade there. Some individuals can be picked out from the Easter Book, where their name is, their occupation is given, as in William Taylor, the piece that goes across, William Taylor Smith, and this is under the list for the South End. We also find William Smith in the account books of St. Catherine's Hospital, the almshouse in Ledbury. 10 years before the Easter Book starts, he was being paid for making hinges and latches for the new parlour door in the master's house, which was being refurbished at the time. And his forge in the South End is also mentioned in his will when he came to die in 1609. He left his house, his dwelling house, lying and being in the South End, near unto the broad pool, to his youngest son, William. We have Borough English in Ledbury. And one of the projects that we did as part of the EPE project was test pit digging all around the town. Lots of people got very excited. And this is a dig on the west side of South End, where Taylor was. And we did find burnt evidence of forge. Now, we do know that this particular property was a blacksmith's in the 19th century, so it's more likely to be that. But could there be a continuity of occupation of the forge on that same site? I don't know that we're ever going to answer that one, but it's an interesting possibility. So the Easter Books do help us to look at the topography and the buildings, how the town grew. On the left, there is a very sketch. Ledbury is blessed with many wonderful documents, but nothing much in the way of early maps or good plans. So this rather sketchy map of 1788 shows how Ledbury was for most of the time until about 1820, anyway. A spine town, the high street running up and down Homend, the long piece going up to the top. By Street shooting out to the left at the top, and the smaller one to the left is New Street, new in the 12th century, of course, and then the church is off to the right. From the East Book, yeah, we can see that the population grew, but also where it grew, so that the Homend on the north acquired 15 new households in that 10-year period. There were more in By Street on the west, whereas the High Street didn't change so much, and certainly not Church Lane going up to the right. You can glimpse a little bit at how the rebuilding might have taken place, for example, in the High Street, because of the run of names. In 1597, there were 3 households between Richard Hall, Gent, and James Teggie, the cutler. In 1598, they've all gone, but in 1599, a new name appears, and then in 1600, another. you can see people beginning to either divide properties or build up down the backyards and develop the burgage plots down the alleyways. So bringing it all together with a final example of Edward Skinner, who was one of our wealthier clothiers in the South End. In the 1590s, there are many deeds surviving showing him buying up burgage plots in the South End, which on that photograph of the that wonderful house which he went to build, South End runs off to the right down this way, and High Street is up to your left. So he's buying up a number of plots, and he builds this magnificent house, which is still there. And there is a date on one of the panels in one of the parlours, which says 1596. I am just so annoyed about whoever chopped off the earlier pages of this Easter book, because if we could have it from the 1580s onwards and suddenly find him living in that house, it would be so nice, because of course in 1597, the first full page, he is living in the South End, and there he is up at the top paying his fourpence for him and his wife, his penny for the garden, and milk for 10 kine, and gains or trade of 4 shillings. By 1607, he's still there in the High Street, still only paying 4 shillings for his gains, but now he's got 2 gardens and 19 cows, and he made 2 payments of tithe calves in that year, each were amounting to 16 shillings. And by now he's also paying tithe lambs and wool, obviously as a clothier. But interestingly, going back to 1597, the piece at the bottom, it's tithes on hops. Our first reference to hops being grown in Hereford, or certainly in Ledbury. He was doing it jointly with 2 other people, Thomas Hall, who was a vintner, and Richard Smith, who also lived in the South End. And the hop yard was actually on the far side of South End. We can tell because where it says it, by the pool next to the vicar's orchard. So very close to where they were living in the South End, they had a joint hop yard, and they paid, whatever it says there, 6 shillings on the hops. We have lots of other evidence, including his super memorial. When he died, his wife died first in 1629, and by 1631, when he died, he was described as a gentleman. He'd been clothier, gradually becoming Mr., and by the time he was buried, he's there in the parish registers as gentleman. So that's given you a little glimpse of some of the uses that you can put an Easter book to, particularly if you can use other supporting evidence as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Thank you very much, Sylvia. Questions?
Can I just ask about church wardens? I know in some parishes they can find that they sort of serve a turn depending on which property they occupied.
Yes.
There anything like that in...
Unfortunately, the church warden's account in the parish book doesn't survive until the late 17th century. This is the one, again, really annoying. That it's very good, and it runs straight through, but it doesn't start till 1686, so I can't relate that to this period, I'm afraid. You win some, you lose some.
Can I ask, was Davis, the vicar, keeping it for himself alone, or was he also recording, was he to some extent making it for whoever got the rectorial? Is it known how those were obtained?
Yes, certainly the upper hall portion, the family who had that at this time actually had it until they bought it out in 1840 or so, the leases. And so their family papers show them gathering in the rectorial tithes. I'm just starting work on those skip papers, so I can't be absolutely sure how good a run, but certainly a lot of their paperwork does show the gathering of the rectorial tithes. And then there are, in this book, there are those portions which they owe, that they pay to the vicar.
Thank you. because the rectorial tithes were not simply, as it were, a greater share of the same things. They
were the corn. Yes, yes, exactly. And those, as I say, I know that certainly there are some accounts for the skips which do show those coming in.
Had that all been set out in a 13th or 14th century composition?
Yes. There doesn't seem to be one surviving "this is it" for Ledbury arrangement. We've been having to piece it together from various bits and pieces. But one of the things, of course, is in this Easter book, where on that bit of Tithe of Corn, where I flashed over it, it does sort of say that the rectory of corn is from the parish, the greater parish, and from these dependent chapelries, which did become separate parishes in the late 16th century. So, quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
So they weren't farmed, then. They were just kept in the hands of the vicar. Because very occasionally these things would be farmed.
Yes, certainly for the period covered here, the vicar is actually dealing with all the small, the mixed small tithes himself, yes. I mean, he actually names his maid who goes out and collects the leeks in one of the pages and things like that. So, as I said, I think he might have been quite annoying in some ways.
Most of them were.
Yes.
The collection of tithes is very interesting. Mm. Have a picture at the front there with everybody queuing up to pay
yes.
their tithes. It didn't work like that.
No,
not in the English village, because tithes were collected
exactly.
as the crops...
As they came in. I mean, this is very apparent in this book because you can. This is obviously the tithes of animals, and you can see the calves coming in over a few months, and then the pigs, a couple of piglets, are coming in at a slightly different time, and then the garden crops again. He's actually putting the month when he's getting things, and the fruit from the gardens, and the pears, and the wardens, and these sorts of things. So it is all. But the eggs were usually collected in Easter week as part of the Easter collection.
Or, what did he do with all those
well,
eggs?
Exactly. In a lot of places, they very soon made it into a cash payment in lieu of the pig bound. Yes.
Valerie, yep. Yes, over here.
Oh, was it? This is completely out of your period, but. I was actually transcribing some 18th century church organs accounts, which actually had the terrier written in within the book.
Yes.
And over the 100 years, it changed.
Mm.
I couldn't cut and paste it,
because
they changed it.
Yes.
And they changed the amounts being paid.
Yes.
Over the time. Do you think that happened earlier, that they were constantly reviewing it?
I think there must have been a little bit of changing, and people certainly were aware of what the value was, because Davies makes comments on some of the items, what the market value is. So, you know, I have the equivalent of, because whatever it was sold for this much in the market this year. And there's also the lovely reference in the, I think it was 1598, it was a bumper crop for apples. Huge numbers of bushels and bushels and bushels of apples coming in, and he records the number of pipes of cider that he made himself that year.
Well, on that note, I think we'll go on proceedings. So, can we thank Silver in the first instance, and then all of us will get yourself to really, really.